This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says?
No, he's not a friend of mine.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
Ah, we stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No way!
Hey, here we go with another Brock and Salk podcast. Hey, man, how are we doing?
Doing good, buddy. How are you? I've got my board in front of me here. I've got Wazoo this weekend.
Whoa.
Heading over to Pullman.
Doing the Coug game?
The USC with the since-fired Clay Helton, the chaos in L.A. Oh,
the ghost team of USC.
Yeah, coming to Pullman. Can Wazoo do it? Can they get that dub? Can they get to 2-1 and beat SC?
Can they get the W that they almost got a few years ago?
Do you remember that?
Yes. Wasn't that the game we were there for, or were we there for Stanford?
It was Stanford.
That was Stanford. Right.
Dude made 5 field goals.
Right. You couldn't make the
5
last one.
5 field goals.
Couldn't make the last one.
Just make the last one, and you beat. I think that was McCaffrey as well, a little running back.
Yeah, it was.
Remember how sick Kyle was to his stomach?
I do. Yeah.
Literally?
Yes.
Yeah,
I remember. I remember being a little sick myself, although yes. I don't think it had anything to do with the outcome of the game. So.
For different reasons.
There's a few different reasons. That was a blast, though. It was fun. I would really like to go back over there. That is definitely still on the list of things that I got to do, being here in Seattle. But look, let's start off, man. I mean, what a Sunday. I mean, for how long were we saying, oh, this doesn't feel like the start of regular season, and we don't know anything about this team? Well, if that's what this team is, and we can talk about how real it is, but if that's what this team is, Brock, we're in for something potentially.
Yeah, it was borderline surreal, wasn't it? Like just flipping it on and feeling like, wow, this is like the first time since the Rams game. Now, you also hadn't seen a lot of other NFL. We had the Thursday night game, a really good game with the Buccaneers and Cowboys. So you kind of had a taste and you knew it would be a little different. But when it finally comes on, I don't know. I found myself like, wow, this is surreal. We get to see Russell again and we get to see this new offense and there's some new faces and some youth defensively, and there's Jamal Adams, and for all of the conversation, my gosh. I remember one time, quick story, David Shaw was so mad. Do you remember that that Pac-12, Pac-10 meetings that I went to that spring with Herb Street? And we challenged the Pac-10, 12 coaches and ADs and Larry Scott and had this big like brouhaha, right? Well, one of the other, kind of tangential, not arguments, but certainly healthy debates was David Shaw. And he was just fired up. He's like, you know what? I had somebody chart how many times Christian McCaffrey on ESPN, on your network, how many times he had his word said or something focused on him versus the other Heisman candidates. And it was ridiculous. You just didn't even give him a chance and blah, 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 blah. And as I was watching that game, thinking, how many times for 9 months, 7 months, what is it, January to September? How many times, how many words did we talk on this podcast? How much has been spoken in the market about Russell Wilson, Shane Waldron, Pete Carroll, Dwayne Brown, Jamal Adams, new offense, and then to finally get to see it over 3 hours and not just see it, but watch it come out and explode in that building on Sunday. Yeah, I kind of use the word honestly. It was a little surreal after all the talk.
Yeah, that was special. And it's not that I didn't expect it, but
I
didn't expect that.
I didn't expect it.
I don't know what I expected, though. I kind of went in without expectations. Like, all right, what are we going to see? It could have been a complete flop. We could have seen something that looked exactly like we used to see. We could have seen them throw it 85% of the time. They could have looked like the Cowboys the other night, gunning it all over the place, and that wouldn't have shocked me. Pete was kind of setting us up for that, right? Like, hey, things change of all that. And instead, they ran it more than they threw it, right? They still ran it more than they threw it.
A lot.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, they Carson had a monster game. They imposed their will through the running game. They still took their deep shots. So in those ways, nothing changed. And yet watching it, everything yes, changed.
Correct.
Everything seemed to change because of the creativity, because of the intermediate passing game, because of their balance and multiplicity and all of it. They looked like a totally different team, and yet they still used a lot of the same principles that we've seen for a decade.
I know it's only one game. I do not want to overreact, but how many times did you have this thought, either during it, after the days now that have followed, as you've talked about it on your 4-hour extravaganza this week? Like, is it that hard? Did it have to be that hard for 9 years?
Right.
Is it like that hard to run screens and jet sweeps and get the play in on freaking time?
Well, it does make me ask this.
Is it that hard?
Well, the play in on time, I could spend the whole podcast on that and how nice it was to see Russell coming up to the line of scrimmage with enough time to audible.
Like UW, was it UW who took a delay game on the first play?
First
how
play
does that happen?
First,
I honestly,
I
thought of you when I saw it. I
turned it off.
Yes. Well, the college football. You don't have a lot of temper.
I don't have a lot of patience, and I came back to it. But in that moment, I was like, I'm not watching. This is ridiculous. How do you take a delay of game? You didn't know what to call? You script the first play.
No, Jimmy took responsibility.
Well, I don't care who's taking responsibility. Jimmy took responsibility. That is absurd. That is a... Well,
Did you ask Pete Monday, first Pete Carroll show back? Did you ask him and tell him, like, dude... Well,
we didn't get into that
one
yet.
Timeout
not
with
yet.
The special teams in the second half, but did you say, hey... Congratulations.
Yeah, like, no, I didn't get into that time. Yet. I was impressed.
Yes.
God, where was I going to go with this? Because I got me
I'm
all
sorry,
off
I interrupted you. You were going to go with set the play clock aside, just the looking and functioning like a normal offense.
It wasn't that. It was
9 years.
It was something much better than... I know what I was going to ask you. You said, does it have to be so hard to do all of these things? And
yes.
And it takes me back to something you've said over and over, right? Teams major in things, right? If you focus on this, or do you try to focus and do a little bit of everything?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fine. For years, you told me, and I believe you, that the Seahawks focused on what they do. We run the ball, we throw play action, we throw it deep. Those are the focal points of what they do. And now it looks like, were they not using all of their allotted practice time? Like, it doesn't seem like that would have been enough to take
right.
all of the time necessary
right.
that you have allotted to you to work on your game plan for the week. And when I watch this and say, well, they look like they majored in everything,
mm-hmm.
it really feels like there was a missed opportunity. And I'm not calling it laziness. I'm not going to pretend like I have any idea what's going on and why and how they used their time in practice. But like, why couldn't they have just also done this?
Oh, well, Michael Salk, you have walked... right into Russell Wilson's camp, what they've been saying for 3 years.
No, they haven't. That's
why
not true.
Why are you not letting me do what I can do?
That's not what they... Well, that's a different thing than what I just said.
It's not a different thing. It's a different window to look in the same house.
No, it's not.
Yes,
no,
it
Mike,
is.
This is an organization that got in trouble for practicing too hard.
Right.
No,
they got
Mike,
fined.
No,
they got
no,
in
Mike,
no, Mike, the
Mike,
joke's on you.
Mike, the joke is on you right now. You're in the
why
cauldron.
Is the joke on me?
You're in the cauldron of
why?
Cooking. You're in the cooking... The Russell cooking. I don't,
oil.
You're in the
pot.
Oil. You're frying in the oil.
I don't want to be in the
you
cooking.
You've gone beyond the class. You are now actually in the pot being cooked.
You know what the best part of my new 4-hour show is? Howdy's not there. It's awesome. I don't have anybody who yells at me like that and like berates me and twists my words around and puts me into cauldrons. It's cauldron free. It's really nice.
Pretty sure the Pete caught himself Sunday after the game that he said, well, Russ was cooking.
No, Pete said, Pete said that on purpose, and you
Pete
know
Pete wrote
it.
That script on Thursday
no
and
kidding.
Then delivered the joke and was like, whoa, did I just say that? Oh, my
and
gosh.
Salk, you just said the same thing without saying
cook. I don't think I did.
No,
I,
you did.
No, the let Russ cook. Stop it.
I think you did.
I'll speak for me. I'll have you know. Little boy Howdy does not get to talk for me.
Cook, 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 cook.
No, the cooking idea is, hey, make sure you throw the ball 80% of the time like the fancy Rams do or the, you know, the greatest show on turn. They're not doing that. They ran it more than they threw it. They completed the circle of toughness. Russ was exact.
What, 23 times? 18 to 23?
Right. I think what they did do, legitimately, I understand your point. I do think that there is an important, even if it's a subtle difference, because they didn't just wing the ball all over the place. They didn't turn this into the run and shoot or whatever the heck the cooking people want. I think what they did was they balanced things, but with a more modern, creative approach to the passing game. Brock, you mentioned the gimmies, and I want to talk mm-hmm. more about those. And the scheme was clearly better and more creative and understood how to get guys open. And I thought that stuff was important and missing. It's not like I was sitting here saying that Brian Schottenheimer needed to be kept around. I mean, like, all right, move on. I didn't think he was all that special. What I do seem to think now, though, and I was talking about it today on Wednesday, is that this does feel like a new phase in Russell's career, that if phase one was his legs, he could throw the ball. Obviously, Russell mm-hmm. always had the skills. But if phase one was, whoa, this guy's got legs, and he can run the read option, and he can right escape and all those things. Phase two was the arm, and we started to see the arm under Brian Schottenheimer and all the things Russell could do with his arm talent and his accuracy. It seems to me like phase three is going to be the head. and that Russell is able now at this stage in his career, and may have been able all the time, I don't know, but for whatever reason, the offense didn't seem to allow it, maybe because they couldn't get up to the line of scrimmage until there's 3 seconds left. Russell now has the time, the ability, the mentality, and the offensive creativity, along with Shane Waldron, if this is the way it looked in game one, to get into phase three, where he's not only fast, although he's losing some of that, obviously.
He looked good. Or
he looked
scramble,
fine.
Though.
Yeah. But he's not, obviously, they're not running read option and all of that.
He looked better than 2 years ago.
He did?
Well, yes, he's thinner, quite frankly. He just looks thinner.
I mean,
he's just flat
as
out
a statement
thinner.
Of fact.
Yes,
he is.
This is
much
not
thinner.
Me talking about his body. He is thinner than he was 2 years ago, and he seems to be, that seems to help. But he's not running as much. The arm is there. And now you're adding in his head. To me, that's the real evolution here.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing from a pure like football perspective, a football analyst, if I'm calling that game, if I'm documenting the Seahawks this season, I think the biggest component, and I don't disagree with anything that you just said, but in listening back this offseason to DK, in listening to Tyler, right, and listening to those guys say, geez, you know, there's a little bit more to this. Because I think for the first time, and again, this is maybe a gross overreaction after just 60 minutes of really clean ball, but I think for the first time, a football analyst says, man, that was some complimentary football. And I'm not talking circle of trust, circle of toughness, circle of offense, defense, special teams. I'm not Regenikind. I'm not talking about any of that. I'm talking about complimentary. That run is complemented by a screen. That's complemented by a play action pass. It's complemented with a drop. It is tied together. Like it has a plan and it's tied together. You've heard Pete reference that a number of different times. The conviction of our BBNN guy and the conviction that he has. And when you think about Mike Shanahan onto Kyle Shanahan, and then the tree off of it with, you know, LaFleur and certainly McVay, because they did the same thing Sunday night, by the way. Big shots down the field, excellent running game, Matthew Stafford comfortable, confident, playing great football. But it's when you kind of bind all of those ingredients together, you make it hard on a defense. Case in point, Columbus, Ohio. I don't think you watched it Saturday morning, but
I did,
you
actually. I watched quite a bit of it. I try to watch all the Ohio State games because I want to see G's kid.
Well, if you watch that, and I saw my little brother Luke on the field in Denver, Colorado game, A&M, and Luke and I were chatting on the field before the game. He's like, man.
I watched some of that in hopes of seeing Luke.
Yeah, well, if you watched, did you see Luke?
He didn't throw the ball at all, though.
No, but in the first half, you saw a lot of Luke on the sidelines. So we can have that conversation off the air. But anyhow, before the game, Luke's like, man, Joe Moorhead, Oregon guy, does such a phenomenal job of putting that defense in conflict. And he's not like overly exotic. It's not any new scheme, like totally revolutionary, but he just binds everything together. And it puts that defense in a total state of conflict. So even Ohio State's 4- and 5-star athletes are flat-footed for a second, or, gosh, is that run? Is that screen? Is that pass? And you saw him. And then, boom, C.J. Verdell's gone 170 yards later, right? Is this a run? Is this a screen? Why were the screens open to the tight ends? Those weren't open in the past with the Seahawks. Well, it's because that defense on the other side, a good defense, that Indy group was number two rush defense in the league last year, right? You put them in a bind. Is this run? Is this screen? Is this play pass? Is it going to be a shot? And, you know, I just thought they complemented and just binded elements of the offense together in ways that a lot of people have been clamoring for.
Yeah, it felt like, look, they've got some really talented skill position players on this team. And it seemed like Shane Waldron understood how to get them in positions to get the best out of them. He put Chris Carson in a position to run downhill. I love the first play of the game. Downhill toss sweep, right? Give Chris Carson the ball. I think that was the first play of the game. They tossed it to him. And when you get Chris Carson in that spot where he can turn the corner and run downhill at you, I think he's really effective.
Yep.
They put DK in positions to succeed. They put Lockett in positions to succeed. The same with the tight ends. And you saw the Disley stiff arm and Gerald Everett doing his thing and would have done even more if it weren't for a penalty that was called early. So, yeah.
And by the way, most importantly, and I know Russell took some shots, and I said that to you Monday. That was probably my only thing, was like, ooh, I cringed 3 or 4 times because he still took some unblocked rushers. So be it in communication or whatever, but by and large, your O-line functioned, even with two different centers.
I didn't get the sense that was their strength in that game. Now, maybe some of that has to do with who they were playing, and I guess we'll find out. But, I mean, if you're going to be in this division, based on what we saw from Chandler Jones and J.J. Watt, based on what we've seen from Aaron Donald and that crew and Nick Bosa and his crew, that offensive line is going to see something better than what they saw in Indy, I think.
Yes, I think that is
And they're
going
to have to be up for that challenge.
You know, by the way, the division was phenomenal.
Phenomenal. All four teams were phenomenal.
They all might four have teams, like double-digit, like, and I know the Lions came back and got a bunch of garbage junk points and yards and everything else. All four teams were up like 15-plus points.
They were all non-competitive victories.
Correct, right. Which in the NFL doesn't happen.
No.
That doesn't, you know, every game's supposed to be one possession. Rams blew the doors off the Bears. Seahawks largely blew the doors off the Colts.
And they might have played four bad teams. I don't know. I mean, we're going to find some of that out, and it might have been those weird fluke week one things. But, yeah, I mean, I my own power rankings, are they four of the five best teams in the league after 1 week? I mean, the only other one I would put up there still is Tampa. I thought they looked better than Kansas City. All four of them did.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, that will be interesting to see. And the offensive line, obviously, is still going to be that focal point where Russ went in the offseason and, hey, this needs to be better. But by and large, Russell was okay. They got hit. He got hit a few times. Mm-hmm. But how much is that balanced off, Brock, by what you said, the gimmies that he had throughout the day?
And it just, and
can
I remember.
Can you explain that a little bit better?
Yes. So, yeah, a couple things. I remember clearly going onto the airplane, and I think it was after the Jets playoff loss in 2002. With Peyton, and I remember walking up the plane, he's like, man, it just is hard. This used to be easy, right? There used to be easy completions, easy checks. It just feels like everything is just arduous. Everything is hard. And, you know, I think they had some off-season conversation, tweaked things a little bit going into the next year where he was in 03, absolutely phenomenal. And I can think of probably the number of times that Russell and Jake, that Russell and Shoddy, that Russell and his team around him, and Russell's just like, man, this is, and frankly, it's what he said to Dan Patrick. I think some of that coming off the Super Bowl and watching, you know, Tom Brady, you know, be able to just win his seventh Super Bowl without having to be Superman and be superhuman, be big in big moments. No question about it. One, you know, road games is a wild card to get to the Super Bowl and all of that. But, you know, when you can take a superstar talent, an elite talent like Russell is, heck, Aaron Rodgers last year, the MVP of this league, and you just give him a bunch of just plays over, I don't know, call it 60 plays in a game, Mike. And if 30 of them, gosh, you know, I can function, and basically any QB in this league can function within it. Like, yeah, this isn't hard. Like, I got this. This is a piece of cake. This is a pop quiz, and I know every answer, right?
And then make a couple of those Russell plays. Throw the teardrops to Lockett, right? Throw the bomb later to Lockett.
How many elite plays did Russell have to make in that game? How many of those, like, whoa, the wizard was out.
I would argue he didn't make any.
Well, the teardrop to Lockett's cover zero was phenomenal.
Elite wizardry?
That's
none.
A great play.
But I thought he made, there were three plays that Russell made in the game that stood out. The two passes to Lockett, and I thought his first scramble was something that not everybody does. What I loved about it is that he didn't go backwards or spin around. He went up and to the right, ran, used his speed, slid, got out of bounds, whatever it was. I thought that was a you know, there are other players, obviously, who do that. Kyler Murray does that.
Sure.
And a lot of the other faster quarterbacks, maybe even guys like Aaron Rodgers who can still move a little bit.
Yep.
So that was a play that not everybody makes.
Yeah.
And I thought that, yeah, those two throws to Lockett. First of all, he throws a beautiful deep pass.
Yes, he does.
I don't know how many guys, I mean, what percentage of quarterbacks hit that one? Not high.
No.
Right?
I mean,
the
corner post was 59 yards. He threw it 59 yards in the air when it left his hand. Not the overall completion. In the air, 59 yards.
That's like the Flutie pass right there.
To a garbage can. You put a garbage can. You know, they do that drill, and the coaches all try to throw the ball in it. Put a garbage can. You football fans out there, go on a football field. Put it 59 yards away from you. And then, you know, he stepped up. He had good protection, but it was still a long developing play. He had to step up. He had rush around him, and he dropped it in the bucket 59 yards away.
The other one, I think probably, you know, my thought goes more to Lockett than to Russ. I mean, it was just an unbelievable adjustment and
tremendous catch.
And, you know, it was funny. Pete sort of was giving me grief about how, because I said, and I'm always amazed at how wide receivers can see out of their helmets well enough to make catches like that.
Yes.
Right? I mean, like a helmet is restrictive. It does restrict your vision. And Pete was like, well, that's because you're not a pro. I was like, yeah, thanks. But it was interesting talking to Bumpus today, and he was like, yeah, no, that's hard. It's harder.
Yes.
It's certainly harder than not wearing a helmet.
Correct.
Right? I mean, God, I saw Mitch Haniger couldn't do that on a ball in right center, ended up leading to a triple just Tuesday night.
And oh, by the way, whether it's sunshine or you're in a dome as well with funky lights, and those guys go out pregame.
It's a heck of a catch.
Yes, I mean all of those dynamics with a roof above you, with different lights, with a helmet, full speed, and you come back over your other shoulder. Mike, yeah, Russell was phenomenal. He was 150 plus QB rating.
But
he was awesome.
He didn't do anything that was specifically
phenomenal.
And
that is the beauty of week number one. Because you know what he is capable of. It's a pitcher, right, that all of a sudden doesn't have to exhaust everything. Doesn't have a 35-pitch inning, and I'm just worn down. It's like, okay, great. You know, I could – there's a ground ball. Yep, there's a ground ball. That's pretty easy inning, right? That was pretty stress-free, as they love to say with pitcher. That's a stress-free inning.
Yeah.
That was a stress-free game.
So two different Russ things I want to ask you about. One relates back to what I just said a few minutes ago, which is the sort of evolution of Russ into some new phases of his career. I didn't notice. Maybe there was one or two read option plays. I think the DJ Dallas short yardage might have been. And the ones in garbage time at the end, as they're just trying to run out the clock, were kind of different. But did they not run read option?
Not much.
Good.
Nope. That's not really Shanahan's deal. Good. I mean, with RG3 a little bit. But no, it is an outside zone, first and foremost, whether that's toss sweep or whether that's an extended handoff or what have you. No, it is.
I loved it.
Yeah,
they don't.
Agreed.
I mean, it has not been effective, nearly as effective for them the last few years. Russell was never keeping it.
We
right?
don't want to. Yes.
So the defensive end is just crashing down every time, which is the whole point of the read option. You're asking your running backs to accelerate later rather than already having accelerated by the time they get the ball. I love the fact that disappeared. I thought that was A+ from my point of view. And then the Agreed. Other was, and Brock, we've been talking about this for years. Short yardage. Did we see the little quarterback sneak that I thought Russell couldn't do?
We did.
Does it turn out Russell can do that?
Those were...
Why haven't they done that forever?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, honestly, if you were to draw...
Every other team in the league does it all the time. Brady's the best at it of all time.
Ever.
Why
all time.
Why can't they just goose and go?
Correct. And oh, by the way, I mean, like, he's strong, he's squatty, he has unbelievable feel, like, he protects himself.
Why wasn't, I mean, I think that they tried it his rookie year once or twice and it didn't work, and they've never done it since.
Yep, those are my three little nuances, my three, like, game within the game, little details. Number one was screens, and more screens. That was the other thing, like, oh, Russell's too small, Russell's too short, can't see it. Not a great feel guy in the screen game. They threw a bunch of them.
Did they throw it into running backs? I don't remember running back ones.
I think they threw one to Chris Carson, they threw a couple to the tight ends.
I remember the tight ends, they tried to set one up to Metcalf, and Russell didn't like it, and he threw it away.
He just one-hopped it, but I love that. Those
he
are
did
just...
that on purpose, though, right?
Oh, absolutely. Right. They played
it
well.
Because I heard Vilma say, like, oh, I bet you'd want that one back. It was set up. Like, I didn't think so. I thought Russ was like, yeah, I don't like this. He threw it away.
Yeah. Kyle, what do you think about that?
Kyle doesn't... He's we're making him remain silent on all Jonathan Vilma moments. Sorry.
That's number one.
Yeah.
Number two was the QB sneak. I just was hooting and hollering like, yes, you see, he can do it. Just like when Drago got cut, he does bleed. You see, he's not a machine.
Not like that at all, but okay.
No, it's not. It's the exact opposite. You see, he can QB sneak. He's capable of it. In fact, is built for it. And that went into great detail with you on Monday. My favorite call of the game was 2nd and 20, two-minute drive. Like, how many times over 9 years getting that two-minute drill? Oh, crud. 2nd and 20, we'll just run out the clock. We'll go in 14-10. We got the lead. 2nd and 20, we'll run it. And it's going to be 3rd and 16. Check it down. No. 2nd and 20. Perfect. Great. And I heard you asking Pete about it, like that two-deep safety and, you know, that route. And Pete's like, yeah, that puts that safety on an unbelievable bind. So if you have 3 to 4 seconds, which it takes for Tyler to set that route up, to get on that safety's toes, for Russell to drop back and hold off that other safety while he's dropping back and stepping up, man, what a great call. You asked me, like, how do you be a play ahead? What does that really look like? Well, that's being a play ahead. Okay, holding call, 2nd and 20, and Waldron's not just like, oh, crud, I don't got anything for 2nd and 20. He's like, okay, great. Once that holding call happens, okay, they're going to play cover 2. I'm going to anticipate it. We've seen it earlier. That's what they like to do in those situations. Less than a minute to go, that's being a step ahead. So now all of a sudden I get Tyler Lockett on a flat-footed safety, and I play to the strength of Russell Wilson to drop a dime from 59 yards.
That safety
there you
has
go.
No chance. No I mean, chance. He's got Lockett's got 25 yards.
The only chance is the other safety coming over.
Right.
And I bet that other safety got a minus on his grade sheet too. Like, hey, man, you're getting to the deep half.
But I don't know what happened to the. I mean, maybe DK's over there doing something
he is.
That guy
he probably
has
is
to
running.
Look at also.
Yep. Absolutely.
He's
Absolutely.
Probably running to the sideline, right?
Yep.
Some sort of an out pattern in order
he's
to
just
open
No, he's probably a straight go running by that that corner trying to hold that safety. But whatever it was, he went in the picture. It was a clear window. And what an enormous, I think that's the game defining play. The difference between going in 14-10 at half and 21-10 is monstrous.
It's so
monstrous.
It's so interesting, kind of, in listening to John Clayton this week talk about Tennessee, and John was like, you know what? I mean, they run the ball, yeah, but then their defense is bad. It's not supposed to work that way, right? If you want to set up a team where you run the ball a lot, you better have defense to go with it, or else you're just a bad team, and maybe we'll see if that's what Tennessee is. The defense was, to me, almost, I mean, we knew more about it, but in some ways, I came away more impressed with what they did than I was expecting to. But also, I still have a lot of questions because I think that Colts offense might be awful.
See, I came away a little more on the latter right there. Like, that Colts offense looked like a bunch of Seahawks offenses that have been scattered.
Well, they don't have any good players on it.
But I think their running backs are pretty good. Jonathan Taylor's a pretty good back.
Running back's fine.
Their backup left tackle, who's starting, is not good.
But Jonathan Taylor, Brock, is not... He's not one of the super elite, completely changed the game. He's not Derrick Henry.
No.
He is a good running back, and that's fine. Their wide receivers are nobodies.
Nobodies.
Nobodies. I mean, nobody in that wide receiving group is going to threaten you, and Carson Wentz might stink. So as much as I come away,
and you feasted on a bad left tackle, right? Their starting left tackle was out, and twice
in
one-on-ones.
Is that where a lot of the pressure came from?
Yeah, two of the sacks both came right there.
Were they missing another starting offensive lineman, too? Two starting offensive linemen?
Well, Quentin Nelson's not where he was supposed to be. I mean, he's been injured, right? He had a couple of different injuries, and then
they had been banged up. Center had been banged up, missed camp. But the big thing was they were missing their left tackle, and we know what life is like with no left tackle. And every play seemingly was
going
down.
Their version of Jamarco Jones.
Yes, J.J. the jet plane, and the play clock ticking down seemingly on every play. They're trying to kill everything. They're trying to get to the right play because they don't have personnel that can just line up and run by and scare people.
And Carson Wentz had like two practices.
Yes.
I mean, he barely practiced. So you know, there's a lot of sort of anti-Colt sentiment for me anyway. I understand that. But take all of that out for a moment because you can only play who you've played. It's not their fault that the Colts have some guy named Paris. I mean, like, that's who they played against.
Paris Campbell, yes.
Whoever, whatever. I mean, I was saying earlier in the week, I watched the game. I still don't know who plays for the Colts. Mm-hmm. Like, none of, like, there's a guy named Allie Cox. I like that
but
guy.
But I thought you said you were watching a lot of Ohio State games. You should know Paris Campbell.
Should I?
Yeah.
Well, I've been watching him now.
Oh.
Right.
They've got Chris
Olave.
Did
Baby Jake get in?
Him.
Is he playing a little?
Haven't seen
end?
Much of him yet, but yeah, I think
that,
he will.
Well, that receiving crew may be the best in the history of college football.
It's really good. That other kid is awesome. And
I guarantee you this. You could put Chris Olave and the rest of the crew, their top three receivers, you could put them on the Colts, and they would have been a bigger threat.
Garrett there's Wilson, no doubt in my mind.
A bigger threat than what the Seahawks
faced. I totally agree with that. But you play who you played, and the one thing I will say about them is I thought they looked fast. And that's something that we've been sort of wondering about. I thought there were two real positives from the Seahawks defense. One, they looked fast. Their linebackers are fast. Their Darrell Taylor was fast. Rasheem Green played fast. I mean, obviously,
I thought for a second he changed his name to Raheem Green.
No, that was a little Kenny Albert.
Yeah.
But, they got that fixed.
Yep, they did. They did.
Jonathan Vilma corrected him. And
I thought for a second, like, dang, did we miss this offseason?
Everyone's changing numbers. You thought Rasheem just dropped the S.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, Clayton tried to push him to Raheem for many years. We thought that effort had fallen flat, but apparently Kenny Albert's picking it up.
Yeah, he's carrying the torch there. But look, the two things they did well, I thought they were fast, Brock. And I thought that their rotation in rushing the passer was the best it's been in a while. Cliff Avril has said that this is the deepest pass rushing group. If Rasheem Green is actually the next beneficiary of the teaching program that Pete has, the developmental program, and this is who he could be, well, you've got a bunch of dudes that are NFL caliber rushing the passer now.
Yes. Yeah, and what did I hear? That he is younger than
D. He's younger than D. Eskridge.
And Stone Forsythe, I believe. Two of the three rookies. Yes.
That's amazing. Well, how nice was it to see those guys not having to play 80% of the snaps?
It was. Well,
and Benson Mayowa can come in wearing number 10.
So deep that L.J. Collier got left back home in Seattle. That was amazing.
That's how deep they are, isn't that? Yeah. It's great. It's good news.
Mayowa wearing 10 sucks. Let me
not
just say that.
Not great.
That does not work. Numerology-wise.
He looks like Jake Locker out there.
He looks like Josh Gordon.
Not work.
It doesn't. I can handle
Dunlap.
Number 8.
Yep.
That's fine. I mean, I wouldn't do it myself, obviously, right. But I understand where he's coming from. I can see 8.
10 doesn't work.
Benson Mayowa should be ashamed.
Darrell Taylor looked better in 52 than I thought he would.
Oh, I thought he's a linebacker,
yeah,
man.
Well, yeah. was okay. Playing with his hand in the dirt.
Sometimes, but he's playing a little strong side linebacker.
Rubber pellets in this case.
I thought he was doing pretty. I didn't mind
awesome
any of that.
To see the amount of rotation with Monet and Puna and Al Woods and Kerry Hyder and Benson Mayowa and Daryl Taylor and Carlos Dunlap. And in a 17-game season, imperative. It was important in 12 and 13 and 14. It is even more so. I mean, that is another, especially in this division, where every game is going to matter in November and December. And to have those guys playing less reps, huge, huge upside.
Yeah. Are you buying Rashim Green?
Rasheem or Rasheem?
Stop. You're going to now confuse
you're gonna get
me.
You're going to get in our head wrong.
Are you buying Rasheem Green?
No, not totally yet. And I know Pete is, and they moved him to a new position, and they're letting him live in one spot, and they cross-trained him, and he was in some spots. No, I've got to see it. Again, he feasted on a really bad left tackle, and they're going to get a lot better, and Taylor Lewan is a lot better this week, in fact, and in your division and everything else. So I got to see it a little bit more, but a huge positive first step.
Well, speaking of feasting, Brock, how about Famous Dave's Barbecue on game day? That's a feast. That's when we start talking about legitimate feasting.
We're going to talk about the Georgia pork again.
They've got the passion, Brock. You know, they got the passion for authentic barbecue. It's behind everything they do. They create that classic Q goodness. They source high-quality meats and trim them up like they're in a competition. The pit masters are keeping the hickory logs smoldering in the smokers all day. The hand-rubbing of the meats. The proprietary blend of spices. Slow-cooking everything to perfection, right? That's why you've won more than 700 awards and why Famous Dave's is the authority in the barbecue world. But now, of course, you got Famous Dave's barbecue on game day. With football being back, you can kick off a winning season with Famous Dave's barbecue. Uh-huh. Do you want to talk about the menu highlights? The All-American Barbecue Feast.
Let's go.
Here we go. This is what I like. Let's start it off right. Full slab, 12 bones of the St. Louis-style spare ribs.
That's lunch right there.
That's my jam right there.
12 bones. 12 that ain't
bones.
Nothing.
No, 12 bones. 12 bones St. Louis-style spare ribs. Whole country roasted chicken. Half pound of either the Texas beef brisket.
Here we go.
Or
the Georgia pork.
The Georgia chopped pork. You're going to go creamy coleslaw, famous fries, Wilbur beans. What are Wilbur beans?
Wilbur beans.
Wilbur. What are Wilbur beans?
What a pig.
Sweet corn, cornbread, muffins. The whole thing is only $79.99. Family style for four to six people. Oh, yeah. Appetizers from the Burnt Ends. Who is it who likes Burnt Ends?
Me.
That's Brock.
Dead and Burnt. Yeah.
I knew there was somebody who was a Burnt End guy.
Love it.
Southside rib tips, wings, onion string. This is ridiculous. We have to stop talking about
this. Yeah, I'm hungry.
1, 2, and 3 meat combo platter, salad, sandwiches, burgers, dessert. I'm done. I can't keep talking about it. I think you get the idea. I think everyone understands when we're talking about feasting that we're talking about Famous Dave's Barbecue on game day. You can order online. Go to famousdaves.com. Well, this is kind of a funky one to talk about, Brock, because by the time this, we're recording, it's almost noon. Mariners start at 1. By the time this comes out, the Mariners season is either over or, right in the thick of, oh, my God, they're right back into this thing. I know that's an exaggeration, but it's not that big of an exaggeration.
No, you have 17 games to go.
You got
to
beat Boston today,
yep,
right?
Gotta win the series.
And I'm sorry that we have to have this conversation not knowing what's going to happen in this game, because it legitimately dictates how the rest of the season goes. Obviously, it's not the official must win. Can you lose this game and sweep your next two? Of course. I mean, there's always another pathway until there isn't one. But it sure feels like this is one you got to win.
Yeah, we're down to it. 17 games to go, including the matinee that's been played this afternoon by the time this goes live on Wednesday nights. Just 17 games to go. And in my mind, you've got to go 12-5. In my mind, as hot as the Blue Jays are with the Yankees and Red Sox, those lineups, Mike, that I still, I look at and
ridiculous.
And part Night of me just scratches my head, how in the world are the Mariners here? How are they doing this and competing to the end? I think you got to win 90 games.
You probably do. But you also see the answer to some of that question when you play these teams, right? Yes, it's brutal.
They're not perfect. Yep.
They're far from perfect.
Correct.
You see the error that Schwarber makes in game one. You see the error that, it was Hunter Renfro made in right field in game two that opened the doors, and unfortunately they didn't capitalize. You see some of the guys who come in and pitch in the late innings, and they're not nearly as good as what the Mariners are throwing at you there. You're right. It's brutal when you're like, oh my God, here we go. Right back through the order. You got to deal with Bogarts, and you got to deal with Devers, and you got to deal with J.D. Martinez again. And you see how deep the teams are, and that's just the Red Sox. You could have done that with the Blue Jays or the Astros. I mean, when you come back through the hearts of their order, apologies to the Mariners, but it is a lot different than when you're seeing Haniger, France, and Seager. They're just they have better parts of the order. They're deeper. The bottoms of the order are better. But the bullpens are not close. The Mariners have pitched very well. They've played excellent defense. They don't make those kinds of mistakes in general. And so you can see some of those differences do show up over the course of a series.
They do. And they've shown up over the course of 100 and
for sure.
Almost 50 games. And yeah, like the Mariners do not have the ceiling that those teams do. Right, that when you watch Vlad Guerrero Jr. and just some of those guys, like, wow.
Crushes the ball.
Correct. I mean, just
you see the ball Devers hit in Game One of this Red Sox series Seawald. Dear Lord, I mean, that ball is tattooed.
Now Kyle can hit him out, and it's 30, his career high, and obviously. Yeah. Haniger, what, three straight nights with a home run? Yep. And you've certainly, Ty France is more than a professional hitter. He's by far the best hitter on this team, most consistent over the course of the season. But as far as star power, as far as just ceiling, like total upside,
it is night and day.
It is night and day. Yeah. But at the same time, like, you've elevated your floor. Like, some of those have holes in their floor that get exposed. And, you know, credit and kudos to the Skip and to Jerry DePoto and for, you know, just knowing who they are, knowing what they are, knowing what they're not. And, you know, it's a little bit different. It's not football where you can necessarily game plan and try to scheme your way to protect your, you know, against the things you can't do. But, you know, there's just a bunch of guys that have bought in, that do believe in one another. And because of it, Mike, I think have elevated that floor to the point that they're still in this conversation with 17 to go.
Do we not talk enough about the fact that there are two professional athletes in two different sports named Hunter Renfrow? We should be talking about that every
day.
Very
confused.
Pretty crazy. Yes.
Now, they spell it slightly differently. One is F-R-O-E and the other is F-R-O-W.
Well, Monday night, I'm flipping back and forth
both
watching
playing.
Both Hunter Renfrow.
Dude, it was mind-blowing. I told Heather, she could not believe it.
One's a wide receiver for Vegas.
Yes.
The other's an outfielder for
Boston. I remember him. He played at Clemson,
yes.
Right? I remember
good
that.
Game-winning touchdown.
I remember good it. Dude.
Possession
good
receiver.
Well, I remembered it because I was like, wait, doesn't that guy play for the Padres? Like, it blew me away then. And it still shocks me.
His name's not Joe Smith.
Right, exactly. There's a lot of Joe
Smiths. There's a lot of Steve Smiths.
Is the Renfrow from the Padres, is he a Southern boy?
I don't know.
Is he a Georgia guy?
Probably.
Yeah. I mean, that's where the other Hunter is, the little receiver.
The whole thing that's remarkable. I mean, I've always marveled over the Evan and Ava Longoria thing. That's remarkable and bizarre. But this is insane. There's two Hunter Renfrows that are both professional athletes at the same time playing on the same. They were playing at the same time on Monday night.
The football player seems to have better hands.
Yes.
Based off what we've seen.
Yeah. He made a big play in that game, helped them win the game. And then meanwhile, Hunter Renfrow's out like 30 home runs or whatever. So I don't know.
Popping fly balls.
That legitimately blew me away that is the case and has for a few years now. But I agree with what you said, Brock. It is at times remarkable that the Mariners are where they are. It's a testament to Scott Servais, who absolutely should be the manager of the year. The more I watch, the more I'm convinced of that. The strings he's pulled, the way he's managed this team, the clubhouse culture, just all of it, I think, has just been really phenomenal. They're not as good. Like, I don't know how else to say it. They don't have as much talent.
Yep.
And yet they're right there with them.
So we had a little chat this week with a Chanticleer. Do you know what a Chanticleer is, Salk? You ever heard of a Chanticleer?
Only in one context.
Uh-huh, a Chanticleer. Do you know whose mascot in college football is the Chanticleers?
That would be Lafayette.
Close.
Coastal Carolina.
Close. That'd be the Cajuns from Louisiana. The Coastal Carolina Chanticleers, number 16 in the country last year, an amazing season.
So what is a Chanticleer?
Chanticleer is the angriest, toughest barnyard animal there is. It's a bird you don't mess with. It's nasty.
Right.
But I was talking to
any birds, but
yeah. Yeah, you would not like the talons on the Chanticleer, Kyle, at all.
Okay.
But we were chatting with one of their linebackers, strong mullet game, hilarious kid, and it was so fun talking to him. He's like, I fear for like life after college football, because what I have here, I don't know if I'll ever find in a business setting or any other venue, because just like the genuine love that we have for one another, and further the belief that we have in one another. That's how we've turned this program and become a national conversation as they were a year ago and beat Zach Wilson and BYU, had a remarkable season, could this year too. And honestly, got me thinking, and I know, you know, we try to define culture, and you and I love that more than anybody else. And sometimes it's misplaced in baseball because these are 25 businessmen doing their job, independent contractors, yada, yada, yada. But the love that you create, and you told me the story earlier this week about Joe Smith.
Oh, my God. I can't talk enough about this. I did probably too much of the show on Wednesday, but I'm really struck by this. And if you didn't hear that, I'll just tell you the story quickly, because it the contrast, the juxtaposition to Sean Figgins a few years ago is so fresh in my mind, even though it's been a decade since that happened. I mean, the game on Tuesday night, second loss to the Red Sox, right? Or the second game, the loss to the Red Sox. Scott made what I think was probably a bad decision, right? He decided it was one of the worst he's made this year. He's really been good at this stuff this year, but I'll second guess it. He decides to stick with Joe Smith going into the eighth rather than just giving the ball to Steckenrider to face Bogarts. Maybe there were some numbers or whatever it was that showed him that Smith would be better against Bogarts. It didn't work. He hits the triple, or, you know, that Haniger could have maybe. Mitch Haniger, not exactly like, you know, a gold glover.
And
right
overplayed,
field.
Overran that,
he's
went back.
He's a little hit and miss.
He's not a right. He's not a gold glover.
He's a
right
hit
field.
And miss gold glover.
He is a solid right fielder.
He can catch a lot of stuff and make a lot of throws, but sometimes he just gets spun in a circle.
Okay, well, we can all have different opinions on this. I'm going to say he's not a gold glover, and I'm going to just leave it there. But so it doesn't pay off. And Steckenrider then comes in, gave it his all, like walked some guys with the base, you know, when he had bases open, but unfortunately just gives up the huge double to Schwarber, and that's pretty much the end of the game. Fine. Well, after the game, Ryan Divish, Daniel Kramer, the rest of those guys, and they talked about this. I want to give them credit because that's how I heard the story. I was not like I was there. They requested him on Zoom. They wanted to talk to Steckenrider about the loss. And Joe Smith said, no. I'm going to go talk to them. You're not going to go talk to them. You didn't have anything to do with this. You did your best in an impossible situation to help me after I screwed it up and gave up a triple. You're not going out there. I'm going out there. I'm the veteran. I'm 37 years old. By the way, this is exactly why they brought in Joe Smith for all the Kendall Graveman conversation. There was equal conversation that this replaced, if not exceeded, what Graveman did in the clubhouse. So he jumps in front of the rookie. He takes the bullets, which is how it is supposed to be.
Yep.
And I couldn't help but remember Sean Figgins sneaking away to the catacombs up in behind the clubhouse to avoid talking about a lousy game that he had and leaving it to Michael Saunders or somebody like that to explain it as a rookie. And I just remember thinking, God, you're the worst. Yep. You're making all this money. You come in here, you dump all over the team and say that you don't like being here. You play like garbage, and you won't take the hits.
Don't take the arrow and the bullet. Nope.
This is a complete, like, if you're trying to define, and this is what Scott's been setting out to do, what does it mean to be a Mariner? It's hard to define that, and it's hard to continue it, and it's even harder when you got Kevin Mather doing his thing and players getting mad at Jerry DePoto for trading for better players and whatever. Like, it is hard to keep all that together. But I think what Scott would say if he were here is what I want it to mean to be a Mariner is obviously to be tough to play against and work hard and all those things that are important, but to have a level of accountability, stand up and do something in for your teammates.
Yes.
To play for everybody, correct, not just with them.
Yes.
And I thought Joe Smith was a great example. I know it was a loss. I know it was a bad loss, maybe even a season-ending devastating kind of a loss. But that was such a positive to me. I couldn't help but be happy about it.
Yeah, I mean, you genuinely care about your teammate. You chat with Hasselbeck, right? Didn't you have him the first time?
Well, I listened to Hasselbeck. All you do is throw out like three questions, and he's got stories for days. It's the best and easiest hour of radio I've ever done in my entire career of working with sorry.
Whoa, what did you just say?
Former Seahawks quarterbacks, yeah, and I've talked to one I would rather talk to.
I've talked to Jake. I've talked to Trent. I've talked to Kitna. I've talked
Jim
to
Jim Zorn.
Yeah, a lot of Seahawks quarterbacks. And working with Matt is a privilege. It's a true privilege.
Are you done?
Yes.
Okay, good. What you asked him about some of the great locker rooms he'd been in, right?
Well, I asked him about the worst locker rooms he'd been in.
Oh, good.
But it wasn't about the like camaraderie. It was about literally physically the worst locker rooms he's been in.
Oh, I got you.
Yes.
He had some great answers.
He said that basically everybody would agree that Buffalo and Oakland were the two worst.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he gave some surprises, like Cowboys' new stadium, AT&T. Yeah. Top five worst visiting locker.
Yeah, but his reason is that he has AT&T service and he couldn't get any there.
Yeah, he's like, oh, there's no cell service. Terrible.
Which makes no sense because it's in the middle of a plane.
All right.
Like, there's no reason.
Can we get back on track here?
Yes, but if you had asked him about his best locker rooms and his favorite teammates and the favorite dynamics in that locker room, it is going to probably boil right back down to what that linebacker said from Coastal Carolina. Like, you genuinely care about the people you work with, right? I mean, heck, our radio show, our first couple years, tough, man. I wasn't looking out for your best interest. You weren't looking out for mine. We wanted to win. It was all about us. There was not a whole lot of trust. There was not a whole lot of belief, as every month it was like, oh my gosh, this is bad. Right. So, you know, trust and belief and really caring about
the trust thing is enormous, bro.
It's huge.
There is a book that we read a couple of years ago when I was still doing the management thing, called Speed of Trust. Have you ever heard of this program and book?
No.
I won't get into the details, but their
theory. I basically
theory,
teach that myself.
Yeah, the,
yes.
The theory is that business can work much better, faster, smoother, and et cetera, only if there is trust amongst the organization. That is the catalyst. That's the engine that makes everything go. And I would say that it's very true on any team I've ever been. And certainly basketball, I always felt like, you know, hey, if I give you the ball, are you going to just be a black hole or are you going to give it back? Right? Like, are you going to give it to me when I'm open? You have to have the trust before you give it up.
Yep.
And I think you certainly in radio with co-hosts, I mean, how many times do you and I trust that the other person, if you interrupt me, there's a reason why, or if I'm going to tell a story, there's a reason why, or however that goes, we trust each other that it's going to work to the advantage of the show. I don't know how you operate without that.
And it's like chicken or egg, right? At times, I think in that conversation, is it a group that just, you know, genuinely trust one another because you got a bunch of really good people, high character people that's in their DNA, or do the circumstances and the experiences further build it? It's what decimated Clay Helton at USC, you know, the game I'm going to call this week, you know, behind the scenes, people I've talked to, like, yeah, there are a bunch of warring factions, right? Between OC, DC, DB coach, all of it. Like, nope, I kind of want to have my turf. You know, when there were some struggles, frankly, and Daryl Bevel gets fired, it's like, well, you know, Tom Cable's this run game coordinator. I got to do this. I got to have my run game, and Bevel's got to make that work. And there's Pete, and how much trust and continuity is there in that staff? Multitude of Mariner conversations we could have over the last 20 years with managers and players and superstar players. Are they really doing it for everybody else? If you know, is he going to have this at bat? Is he going to do it within this at bat for, you know, what's best for me that's next in the lineup, or is he going to be looking out for himself?
And I don't think this team trusts ownership or general managership. I mean, I think they showed that the moment anything even like small, like they just were immediately ready to go right after them, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that went away in the last month. That's my guess.
Yep.
So I don't know how much trust there is there yet, although I would hope that the results of some of those deals and bringing in Castillo and bringing in Anderson and bringing back Toro, I would hope that those things go a long way towards building some of that trust.
Mm-hmm.
I do think there's a lot of trust within that clubhouse with Scott, with the players and how they do play for each other. I think that's been pretty remarkable. And I'm not saying it's the reason they are where they are. They've pitched really well. They've been in the right positions.
Played
they've come up with big
defense,
hits.
By and large.
There's a lot of other reasons why they've done what they've done. But I don't think you can ignore it either. I mean, like, that is a relevant part of how you end up right in the thick of things, despite being outscored in the year by 50-plus runs. There's got to be a reason. And when there is nothing else explicable, you have to turn to the inexplicable. And that's where that camaraderie, that culture, and all of that, I think, plays right in.
Yeah.
You know, over the next few weeks, Brock, we'll start to, depending on what happens, either get really excited about a playoff run here, or start talking about how this really got done, what was real and what wasn't, right? I mean, how much of this was Kyle Seager, who's probably not going to be back? How much of this is Mitch Haniger, who maybe only has another year here?
Mm-hmm.
How much are we really seeing from the kids, and do you believe in them? Some of them are going to be here. Toro's going to be here. I believe in the bat. I've also watched the glove. If you think that he's going to go across the diamond, replace Kyle Seager, and immediately be the same level of third baseman, I'm not calling him a butcher, but he could use a little work with Perry Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And Perry may make him better. But that's not Kyle Seager over there and the number of runs that Kyle Seager takes away, right? So there's some real conversations to be had. I'm not sure that Cal Raleigh can hit the major league level. He might be able to, and it's going to take him a little longer as a switch-hitting catcher especially. But I don't know that we found out this year whether or not Cal Raleigh is a major league hitter who's going to add and extend your lineup. We have not found out whether or not Jared Kelnick is a major league star who's going to deliver. I mean, he's hit some home runs now. He does have 10 home runs in limited playing time as a rookie at 22 years old. So there's certainly a lot of the promise. In the last week or two, Howdy, you got to admit, Kelnick's hit much better. He has looked
much better for a week and a half.
Yeah.
And that same span, he's been so much more like red flag, yellow flag, diva related stuff than the entire season during that too. That's a major,
I agree. I am super done with him complaining about strikes. Like, if you want to complain about balls, okay, fine. You know, he's complaining about strikes. The issue in the outfield and all of that. Like, yeah, I think there's some things to watch there, and that things we don't know yet about how this team is going to be built. Logan Gilbert's start against the Red Sox was a huge building block. Mm-hmm. Goes a long way towards telling me what he might have up in store for us. But this sort of conversation about what's real and what's not is going to be a really big one heading into this offseason.
Just listening to you, the two words are just kind of resonating back and forth in my head. The tangible versus the intangibles. Mm. This season feels like so many intangibles, so much of the leadership, so much of the culture, so much of the joy, so much. But the tangible is your minus 50 in run differential.
Right.
The tangible is, man, the middle of that lineup compared with the Astros and the top of the American League. Like, it's still got some work to do. Oh. The tangibles of remember Kyle Lewis? Remember Evan White? Remember some of those young pieces too, and the young pieces down in Double A that are starring. Like, there is a ton of tangible conversation to come
and tangible differences, as you state, between them and the best teams in the league. So how do you maintain the intangible cultural changes you've made while adding some more tangible, better players to this lineup? That's literally what is on Jerry DePoto's radar for this offseason. It's going to be a lot of fun to watch.
This is Brock and Sox Blue 88.
Blue 88! Blue 88!
We take you to the field as Brock Huard breaks down three football questions as only he can.
Now here's your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Sox.
All right, Brock, let's finish up. It is football season. I want to go through a little Blue 88 with you. Three good football questions. I'll start here. I love this USC story. You know me. I love a good college football story. I'm always on coachingsearch.com or whatever it is Kyle's telling me.
Yeah. Football Scoop. Yeah, you're big.
I'm big on that.
Pete Thamel.
Yes.
Yeah. Kyle, what are those websites I'm big on?
Yeah, right. You know, Kyle, remind me about those ones I like.
I love coaching.
Why haven't you evolved, by the way? Like, you know, the rest of us, I feel like I've evolved into baseball, reading Baseball America.
Devolve.
I feel like I'm going to evolve with hockey.
Ask
coming.
Mike about the upcoming Ryder Cup, and then tell me he hasn't evolved.
Seriously, Brock, I only have time for so many things.
I can't watch
college football during Q school qualifying. All right, like I can only watch one thing at a time. All right. So, who is going to replace Clay Helton in USC, and is that still a top five job?
I have no idea who is going to replace him.
Urban
I know
Meyer.
who I would go after. It would not be Urban Meyer.
Please.
I know that's who you want. You would love that circus to come to town. I can't imagine.
I will never, literally never stop laughing if Urban Meyer quits the NFL to go back to college at USC.
Knowing the way the owner there is wired in Jacksonville, I'm going to guess there is just some like beyond poison pills in that contract.
Good.
That when they signed him, like, you are not
it
leaving.
Buries him.
Yes, you are not leaving.
I
after
hope he
one
tarnishes
year.
Every part of his reputation.
Yes. I don't think it is still a top five job. I think it was when Pete inherited it in the early 2000s. Now, they didn't have the facilities. They didn't have the resources. But it had an incredible heritage and still was so close to and still tied to some of that history from the 70s and 80s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. But, you know, you've got youth that are growing up now in this recruiting world. And all they have seen, kind of like Washington for that matter, is they have seen the best leave. They have seen DJ Uiagalelei leave to Clemson. They've watched Bryce Young leave to Tuscaloosa. They have watched those powers from the SEC, from the Big Ten, even from the Big 12, pull some of the best talent out of that state. So there has been an exodus. I don't think it's easy to live in L.A. I think the state of California right now, and that place in particular.
I disagree with that. I think it's pretty easy to live in L.A.
Where are you going to live?
Wherever
Where
I want. I'm going to be a coach
Clay
at
Helton
USC.
Live like in Palos Verdes and try to commute
nice.
In.
That's his fault.
Right.
Well, it's you know, that is not
there's plenty of place to live in LA. Trust me, you'll be okay
for an entire staff.
Yeah,
and it, because it's not just one guy. I mean, yes. You know, Chris Peterson turned down that job.
Yes, honestly, and I'm not joking. There are, because all of those guys know they know how long they're going to be there. They're renting, not buying. Buying in LA, crazy, impossible. Renting in LA, not so.
Okay, all right. But I do believe that factors in. Oh, by the way, in your conference, you have a school 1,000 miles to the north that has a swoosh for a mascot that is going to be running the show and has a, and is committed to it and will continue to commit to it and continues to take your kids. So I, as we sit here today, I cannot say that that is a top five job. I think it will you know, attract many. I think there's a bunch of them. Eric Bieniemy is a name that continues to get mentioned. You know, he's been interviewed a gazillion times for NFL jobs. He has said that that is the one job. He's a Southern California guy that he would be attracted to, possibly, if it came open. So that would be a name to certainly keep an eye on.
All right, question number two. As we continue, this is an all-college football edition, Rock. We've done enough NFL for today, so all-college stuff today, since I know that's where your mind is specifically. Well, I'll keep this very simple. Why is this UW offense historically bad?
Because they're playing by my rules from 25 years ago. They're running the sets that I ran 25 years ago.
But why?
I because they think we can just line up and we're bigger and we're badder and we're going to just blow you off the ball. And they're not doing that physically. They're not that talented on the offensive line. Scott Huff, the offensive line coach, I think deserves a ton of the criticism right along with John Donovan. What'd they go, 19 possessions without scoring in college football? You think the rules are easy to score in the NFL, Mike? Do you watch college football? No, you don't. Sorry, that was a rhetorical question. I knew the answer to it. But if you did, you would see that scoring's even easier in college football. Why, you may ask? Well, because of the hash marks, the amount of space that you can play in. Why, you may ask further? Because linemen could go 3 to 4 yards down the field and run past freaking option plays that everybody runs in college football. Do you run them? No. We're just going to line up and blow you off the ball because that's what we did 25 years ago.
Are you okay?
No,
it doesn't
I'm not
sound
okay.
like you are. It sounds like you're pretty. I mean, legit.
Howdy, does
I'm
that
not,
feel good? Do you like me venting?
Yeah, like, that feels great. And you didn't even get to the point that they're supposed to be good at this. If there was a team in the conference that's supposed to be good at this, it should be UW with their personnel.
Let me say this without actually needling. You legitimately sound embarrassed.
Oh, that's yeah. It's legitimately the offense the first 2 weeks of the season, legitimately embarrassing to the point that Arkansas State, I don't care that you're 17 points favorites, they're going to score. And oh, by the way, you're also calling defense. I'm not just going to give the defense a pass. You gave up 350 rushing yards to Michigan. You played your safety 25 yards deep for what reason? Do you think that quarterback that went 5 of 16 for 44 yards was a threat? I mean, what are we doing? Do you have Vita Vea and Greg Gaines and Elijah Qualls? No, you don't. But why are you calling defense like in Ben Burke-Kirvin like you still do? It is perplexing. It is embarrassing. And yeah, I think they're, and I speak for a lot of Husky Nation that is beyond angry schematically at what you are doing. Are you down wide receiver? Sure. Are guys banged up? Absolutely. But you still have enough horses in the stable to go 19 possessions without scoring? And it is easy to bag on the quarterback. Oh, Dylan can't do this. Dylan can't do that. He has some limitations. But when you are calling scheme from the rules of 25 years ago and you are not taking advantage, it's like that story I told you about an old NFL player. Right? When the 401k and the union reps came to the building, we're like, yeah, man, 401k, do it. We should have 100% participation in 401k. They're putting in $2 for every dollar you put in. And one of the teammates is like, don't do it, man. Don't do it. Just try and take another one of our dollars. Like, no, you do it. Because you put in 10 and then all of a sudden your account shows $30,000. Do you know what you do? You run pass options. Do you know what you do? Let your linemen get down 3 yards down the field so that defense is in conflict. So it makes it hard on a defense. You know what's not hard? Lining up and showing them what you're going to do so they tee off on you. Next.
Question number three.
Is there a next?
Do we have to do a third question?
No, we
honestly,
can be done.
I'm done. I don't want to ask anything else. Brock, seriously, that is... Well, I mean, I've known you now since 2009. I don't think I've ever heard you. Well, I've probably heard you that worked up. I won't say I
did. Oh, I've been a lot more worked up.
I know I have.
Between you and me.
But I've never
pent up.
But not about the Huskies. And honestly, I mean, I'm trying to take down the sarcasm level for a moment. Seriously. Because generally my feeling is you do make excuses for them. You're willing to excuse a lot of what happens there because I get it. I give you grief about it, but I understand why. It's your alma mater and you love them and that's fine. You're a fan. But you don't sound like the Brock Huard I know today.
Oh,
this must have really gotten to you.
Oh, it was frustrating. And what a scene it was at Michigan. You know, actually, Damon went there. He said it was unbelievable. I mean, 108,000 people in that place.
I really want to go there. That is one of the bucket list things.
108,000 people sing and song. They didn't even show because you have to be so careful at ESPN with the music and the trademarks. So they don't even show all the singing that goes on in between quarters and series. It's like a concert. And, you know, they all got the pom-poms and the history, and they're great fans, like multi-generational fans.
I got to tell you, man, I'm sorry. As I listen to you talk, and I don't have much of an opinion on this myself, but as I listen to you talk, a day after Clay Helton got fired, one game into or two games into the season, I don't know how Jimmy Lake's possibly going to survive what you just said.
Well, I'm not.
I know you're not blaming him. I'm not saying you are.
Yes.
And I'm not saying that he should be fired. I don't know enough about it to even come close to making that call. But listening to you talk like that, and just the I know how measured you are, and honestly, how optimistic you generally are about the Huskies. You haven't talked like that since the 0-12, coming off of that. I haven't heard you talk that way.
Yeah, well, it is schematically just very tough to watch.
And the recruiting is tough, too. They've lost a ton of good recruits who've
atrocious.
Left this place.
Yes, you have.
You can't do both of those things. Nope. How can you have bad scheme and bad recruiting?
And by the way, it wasn't 25 years ago or 30 years ago. It may have been you won a national championship. Mike, you were there when they played Alabama. They weren't manhandled. They weren't embarrassed completely.
Nope,
there was a big pick right before halftime.
Yep.
That if Browning didn't throw that pick, that could have been an interesting game. You had elite people in your front seven, right? All those guys I referenced played in the NFL. Buda Baker is an all-pro in the NFL. Like you had elite people, but you put them in positions for success. And, you know, when I watch this and the number of just, that's dead on arrival, that's dead on arrival, that's dead on arrival, that's dead on arrival, like that you're just running into numbers. Mm. And then you keep, you know, five or six in the box for six to block you because, well, you know, this is what we do. We limit, you know, pass plays and explosive plays. That's fine. But at some point, that quarterback's got to beat you. At some point, you put eight or nine in the box and dare you to play. You know what your strengths are? Your two corners. So go ahead, beat us man-to-man. We'll put eight or nine around the box. But to continue to have a light box as well, it was just, man, was it hard to watch over the weekend.
Well, I'm sorry, man. This was fun in general. I'm sorry it ended on such a down note. It started off
with
very
that.
Positive. I mean, generally, you know, Brock is the negative one, and he's gone in that direction
to agree
today.
With
I'll be interested to see if people
do. There is no question, and Howdy knows it. I speak for a lot of Husky fans, and I've gotten a bunch of texts from them, in a bunch of emails, and just people that are beyond frustrated.
Yeah.
Like, because that is not... That's not like one bad call. That's not like one tough situation. That is a holy smokes. Like that's Montana that beat you. And then that's a good Michigan team. That's not a great Michigan
team.
That is a very average quarterback.
They smothered you.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, they beat you 31-10. It wasn't that close. So
I'm wondering how they're 17-point favorites this week. They've yet to score 17 points in a game.
I think that Vegas literally
doesn't. How would they get a 17-point lead?
I don't think they know who they're playing. I think I've never heard of this team either.
Next week, Jimmy Lake said there would be change. There would be some changes.
Okay. Well, let's see what that is.
You better start spreading it. You better start having some run.
You're
going to
change
components.
Your entire philosophy week two of the season? Come on.
You bet. Did you watch the first two games?
No, but you can't tell me that that's a good strategy either. Like,
Mike. It cannot be a wholesale change. It cannot be a wholesale change. You're absolutely right. You've majored in this, back to my minor and major, but those minors, those screens, a little RPO game, you have to take advantage of the rules of college football.
And all of this after Oregon knocks off Ohio State. I mean, it's a phenomenal, crazy difference. Thing to see. All right, we got to go. Brock, we're done for the week. We will come back. I cannot talk anymore today. I'm going home. I'm shutting my mouth, thankfully, for everybody out there for a while. And you and I will discuss this more in more detail next week. So we will talk again on Wednesday. Until then, Brock, the hey.
He's in the bar.
See everybody.
This is the chopper!